Hey everybody, welcome back. This is Film Baby Film, the podcast for people who love movies, or films if you're being pretentious. I'm your host, John Lobager, and today I'm very excited about today's episode. I'm joined by James Hancock of Wrong Reel. If you're listening to this podcast, you've probably heard of Wrong Reel already. Is it the most popular professional amateur film podcast that's out there? It certainly is a big one in my circles. It's the podcast that inspired me to get into the game and talk about movies. And I'm really excited that James and I got to connect. Today we're going to be discussing the book by Ben Fritz, The Big Picture. If you haven't heard of this or read this, I highly recommend it. I would recommend this book to not only to people that are really into film, but also anybody that's into business. And it's just a really good business book. If you think in terms of like Michael Lewis books or any of those other business books where they're very readable and narrative driven, character driven, this is certainly one of those books. Very entertaining. I definitely recommend it. But specifically for people that are really into the film business, it's very interesting because there's all these trends that are going on and you read about them in bits and pieces wherever you get your business news. And so this book like really compiles all of that stuff together, but does it in such an entertaining fashion. It's a really great book. I definitely recommend it. And I can't say enough about James and his podcast. And definitely check out Wrong Reel if you hadn't. They go in depth on so many different topics. It's everything from Star Trek episodes to they have many episodes about Ingmar Bergman. So really just something for everybody. And James is one of the best podcasters out there. So definitely check it out. We do have an episode coming out. I'm very excited to do the year-end episode. I'm going to have DJ Moore on again this year. I'm in that stage of there's 10 movies that I want to see over the next couple of weeks before I feel completely comfortable doing my year-end list. Certainly a few movies that I'm fairly confident will be on there. So I'm really excited about that. And, you know, it's interesting, the stuff we talk about on this episode, a lot of it is about streaming versus traditional theatrical release films. And, you know, now that I'm going through the movies I want to watch for the top 10, you know, my year-end list, about half of them are available on Amazon or Netflix right now for free, including movies that I've already seen in the movie theater. You know, I still have to see The House That Jack Built got released on video on demand, so I can rent that from iTunes. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs on Netflix, The Other Side of the Wind on Netflix, and, of course, Roma. And then over on Amazon Prime, Zama is already released there. And then Western, which was one of the Film Comment year-end picks. So it's a very interesting time. 2018 definitely has like a lot of trends that have come to the fore. And, as I'm preparing for my year-end list, it certainly is like a reminder of how much things have changed. And this episode, we get to talk about a lot of the stuff that's been driving those changes. So, I mean, who else would you want to talk to about this sort of thing than James? I can't think of anybody. And I guess the last thing I'll say is I got some positive feedback. I like to thank the positive feedback guys, mostly because I want to incentivize people to give me positive feedback. That's so manipulative. Andrew Pierce has been a big fan of the podcast, and I'm a big fan of him and the work that he does over at The Curb. I'm looking forward to getting, I don't know if he put out his year-end episode yet, but since he's from Australia, like, they have a different release schedule, so that's always fun. And then, you know, Film Baby Film super fan Daisuke Beppu, and also just super person Daisuke Beppu. Definitely check out his YouTube channel if you haven't. I watch it as often as possible. Man, this intro has gone on way too long. Guys, I have James Hancock from Wrong Reel. This is the guy that, like, the fast-talking podcaster that inspired me to make my own podcast, so definitely check it out. I mean, you're already here. It's too late. You got to check it out. So yeah, film baby film. James Hancock from Wrong Reel discussing Ben Fritz's The Big Picture. Let's do this. It's like food. Movies are like food in that I really enjoy eating food, but it's almost even better to talk about the food afterwards. And it's the same thing with movies. Like, you know, I may see some great Alfred Hitchcock film and it's really terrific and it blows my mind when I'm sitting by myself, but it's like even it really ups the ante. It makes it a lot more enjoyable when I get to talk to somebody who's also super passionate about the same stuff that I am afterwards. So,
yeah, you can't live on an island. I mean, it's one of those things where if you lived in total isolation, would you even still watch movies? And that's an interesting question. Like, what would you do if you never had any sort of exchange with other people? Because at that point, the consumption of art becomes a completely different thing. And I don't know if I'd continue watching movies or not if I just was like, you know, a man on an island for all eternity.
Yeah, and that sort of connection. When I was listening to, I listen to all of the Dave Eves, Becky Dana, Ingmar Bergman episodes. I'm a huge Ingmar Bergman fan. I actually went to Fulda. I went to Bergman Island and went to Bergman Week.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and so I'm a big fan, and so I love those episodes. And when I was listening to you guys discuss Scenes from a Marriage, and then this book came up, The Big Picture, the book we're going to be talking about today. Like, my brain melted because I had just picked up the book from the library the day before, and you guys were like saying how great you thought the book was. I was like, holy shit. I read it that night. I could not get to sleep until like 2 a.m. Because I was just totally enthralled by particularly the beginning part where we hear about the Sony hack and about Amy Pascal's rise to influence inside of Sony Pictures, and then, you know, the beginning of her downfall. It was gripping to me.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those books where you're going to read it in a few sittings, no matter what. I think I read it in like 2 to 3 sittings. And in New York, usually most of my reading is on the subway or while standing in line for something, like, you know, reading on my phone. But I basically would invent excuses to stay in that world. I mean, Ben Fritz, he brings it to light. I think the first half, like you mentioned, unfolds almost like an Adam McKay kind of Big Short drama. But the second half is so rich with information about today's competitive landscape and why we see the movies we see and where we see them. I found it to be probably the best book about the movie business as it stands that I've come across in at least 5 to 10 years.
And so do you think that this book really hits home because it touches on the stuff that you and I really care about, both because the book touches on both the way that Hollywood used to operate, you know, some adult dramas, and obviously there'd be big Jaws or Star Wars types movies. But now the shift towards franchise, like, you like the art house stuff, you like the more mid-range drama stuff, but you also are a big fan of the comic book movies. Do you think if somebody wasn't really interested in film and in where it's going, that if they read this book, they would be just as interested as you and I are? Plus the business aspect of it. I have my MBA. I think I've heard that you have your MBA as well.
I do.
Like, this is sort of – is it just that it touches our – it pushes our buttons? Or is it that this would be, like, really entertaining to anybody that wanted to pick up a good narrative?
I think the first half would be entertaining to anybody just because you're watching this train wreck in slow motion due to the Sony hack, and just there's so many embarrassing secrets that spill out. But the second half, I imagine it would appeal to anyone interested in film history and trends that emerge over time. I imagine that it will appeal to anybody who loves blockbusters and franchises, etc. And I definitely think it appeal. I mean, Ben Fritz works for the Wall Street Journal, so it should come as no surprise that his writing would have a business angle to it. So I think anybody who's interested in investing in any of these companies, whether it be Netflix or Apple or Disney, whatever the case might be. But I think it's really important in today's media cluttered landscape always to be aware of where your media is coming from, why it's coming to you, is there an agenda attached to it, and just being much more savvy about where our content's coming from. And I think this book probably illustrates that better than, I mean, there are no other books on this topic that articulate it so carefully and with such thorough detail. So I think it actually is one of the more important books of our time in terms of just charting a path from the corporate politics to how it affects what appears in front of our eyeballs. I think it's enormously important on that front.
And it's kind of funny because it's almost like you've gone from a film podcaster to a film business podcaster over the last few days, because I just listened to episode 437, which is about Filmstruck. And to some extent, you really can't with Disney acquiring Fox and with AT&T acquiring Time Warner. There's no way that you could really hide your head in the sand and not be thinking about the political landscape of film if you're a big film fan. But if you're an art house film fan, there was no way that you could avoid corporate politics once the Filmstruck debacle occurred.
And Fandor just laid off their entire workforce. They're keeping it alive temporarily. I think they're selling it off to different management. But it looks as if Fandor, at a bare minimum, will be going through some fundamental changes. And whether or not Fandor will continue to survive, I don't know. But Fandor, I've always felt like, is kind of the weaker, dumber, slower, younger brother of Filmstruck. But I have used Fandor as a resource. I mean, for my podcast, Wrong Reel, I do an enormous amount of research. So any platform that has a great library, I'm a subscriber. So I continue to be a Fandor subscriber, but they're finding it to be an uphill battle as well. But what's interesting is seeing how A24 now is becoming a supplier to Apple, and seeing Amazon Studios continuing to thrive because they have such deep pockets and they're acquiring all these great foreign films and independent films. So I think there's lots of green shoots out there. But what's crazy now is that we live in an era where it seems like the lay of the land is changing faster than ever. And it's hard to get a sense of just what is the status quo, because it seems to be reinventing itself every few months and every few years. So I think if you are an art house fan, there's plenty of reasons to be excited. It's just whatever you're excited about is going to be fundamentally different in a very short time.
Yeah, I mean, purists like the people at Cannes who say, I don't want to have any movie that isn't going to be shown in France competing for the Palme d'Or or in competition or anything like that, or really just any art house purist that says, well, I don't care about the streaming wars. It's like, no, actually, you really do care about the streaming wars. You just might not know it yet. But I think even now with Filmstruck, and then on the other hand, some of the positive stuff like you mentioned, like the stuff that's going on at Amazon Studios, Netflix with The Other Side of the Wind and the amount of money that they invested in that, there's nobody that can hide from the corporate politics that's going on, no matter what kind of media it is that you're consuming. Art house fans, even though I like comic book movies, and even though I also think with a business mind, I'm really interested in what's going on at the big studios, even the people that are producing stuff I might not necessarily be addicted to consuming the way I am addicted to consuming Ingmar Bergman films, for example. Like, you still have to know this stuff because this will eventually impact you.
Well, there are always going to be curmudgeons and knuckle draggers who fight and resist technological change in any way, shape, or form. I mean, my older brother's one of those guys where the idea that smartphones even exist is like, just like, it's like Atlas holding up the weight of the world. It just, the whole technological landscape bewilders, confuses, and frustrates him. So I think whether you're talking about Cannes or the Academy, whatever the case might be, there are always going to be people that really fight to maintain whatever power and influence they once had. But man, if you don't you don't have to embrace technological change, but if you don't at least try to wrap your arms around it and understand it, I feel like technology has a tendency just to mow you into the ground. It's like Magnificent Ambersons watching, the family who loves their horse and buggies, loves their buggy whips, and they love their way of life, and they're watching this city heave and grow and change around them, and they're just a few steps behind the changing of the times, and obviously it destroys their entire complete way of life. So I think there are a lot of examples of this happening in the past, And it's always a good idea to keep your eyes wide open during periods of rapid change.
Yeah, and so that's particular to me. I remember I heard you say something about the knuckle draggers and the people that are purists and only want to see it in theaters. I mean, I had the experience of not understanding why Citizen Kane was a good film when I watched it on my laptop, you know, 15 years ago. And then I went and watched it at a local art house theater. Boston is very lucky, you know, like world-renowned comedians. Boston also punches above its weight in terms of art house film theaters. And so I'm over at the Brattle Theater with like three other people watching Citizen Kane. And by the end of it, when the smoke is rising from and Rosebud is burning, I'm like standing and clapping and crying at the same time. It was a completely, like it completely changed my view on what is one of the most, you know, one of the biggest, most famous art films ever made. And so I am a purist. But then there's also a part of me that is like, things are changing, you know, that MBA mindset of things are changing, pay attention. Money is, massive amounts of money and capital are also going to be changing hands. You can't just hide and, you know, wish that everybody was hanging out in the movie theater all the time.
That's funny. Mentioning the theater experience, I love it as well, but I so rarely have a great theater experience. Yesterday, when I went and saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, it was an advanced screening, so a lot of people are in line to get in because it's a free screening. And I'm front row center, and up until the movie's about to start, I had my entire row behind me and to the right and left of me, totally to me, just totally like my own little personal screening room. And suddenly this enormous family comes in and they sit to the right, to the left, and behind me. And during the whole movie, there's a crying toddler trying to get from the row behind me to the row in front of me because there's one kid that he wants to sit next to. The mother, who had halitosis and a cough, is coughing what smelled like a combination of like death and like bacon grease under the back of my head the entire movie. And the movie was still amazing nonetheless. I had a great time. But I was just thinking, man, if I could be watching this at home, lying on my couch with my headphones on, total control over my environment, like this would be pure bliss in heaven. But the flip side of that is when I went and saw Mandy this fall at the Alamo Drafthouse,
oh yeah,
they will throw people out of the theater for using their phones. Everybody there was a movie nut. They were all there to get weird and have a good time and watch this deranged movie and really get in the proper mindset. And it was one of these transportive out-of-body experiences that you have like once every 10 years. So I still really value the theater experience, but I'm not going to cling to it so desperately that I refuse to acknowledge that someone like Dave Eves, who's a massive cinephile in Philadelphia, they just don't have the opportunity to see movies like Citizen Kane in the theater or whatever the case might be. And so embracing technology is really his only option.
Oh, yeah. No, we have friends in the Criterion Facebook groups and whatnot who are from Kansas. And, you know, you want to talk about a difficult time. I mean, Philadelphia or Pittsburgh might have a hard time with their art house film. I mean, just imagine what it's like living in Kansas. You can't find it anywhere. And so things like Filmstruck and all that were amazing resources. So, but what's interesting is your experience watching Into the Spider-Verse is like the ultimate encapsulation of what is going on in this book, because Amy Pascal, and so the whole book is, the beginning of the book is oriented around the Sony hack. And so while Ben Fritz wants to tell all of the, talk about all the different trends that are happening and essentially why it is that we're moving from a movie industry that like 1989, Rain Man was the biggest grossing movie in the world, to a place where, you know, all of the movies that are successful in the box office are reboots, comic book movies, sequels, so on and so forth. And so, but he wanted to tell that story in the context of a movie studio. And the Sony hack and the drama that happened with Amy Pascal and Sony afterwards was the framework in which he reveals that. And of course, they're the people with Spider-Man. And so you want to talk about, and she really resisted, or at least the book makes the argument that she was, while at the forefront of making Spider-Man a big success and therefore like making a lot of what we are experiencing now, bringing that forward, but also she was sort of dragging her heels and continuing to pursue the old model. And so,
yeah, she loved like best-selling books and developing a relationship with talent and placing a huge emphasis on the star system and developing relationships with filmmakers. But it really was one of those classic models where you make a big, diverse slate of movies with a bunch of different genres on a bunch of different topics. You do the best you can. You follow your gut. You roll the dice and hope that enough of them basically are successes to outweigh your losses. And it's the way that a lot of Hollywood ran for a very long time, where you just have the gut instinct and hopefully great taste in movies. But it's incredible how with Spider-Man 1, she ushered in the era that would prove to be her undoing, because Spider-Man 1 obviously did just fine. And it was one of the key instrumental movies that basically ushered in this 21st century franchise boom, which was a boom that she really didn't want any part of.
I mean, so now we're really in the world of the book. There are some things that happen in this book that so blow my mind. And I think the most immediate one is when some of the executives at Sony knew that they wanted to make Spider-Man movies. I think they originally wanted James Cameron to be the director. But they like knew that specifically they wanted Spider-Man, and they thought that they could make him the center of a series of tentpole movies, make a bunch of money. Awesome, right? When they bought the rights to Spider-Man, they were also offered the rights to every other Marvel character except for the Incredible Hulk, who I think was over at Universal.
Yep.
And it was for a total of $25 million.
Worlds turn on these moments.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. So what was did you know about this when you read this part? Did you, I know that you're a big comic book movie fan and a big movie business. You pay attention to this sort of thing. Like, did you know all this, or was it?
I knew some of it. Like, there are books like Marvel, The Untold Story, which track basically Marvel from the 60s up through the present day. And I was in business school from 06 to 08, and this was long before Iron Man, because I basically graduated right when Iron Man popped, and that's when suddenly people realized that Marvel Studios was going to be a thing. But I did a lot of research on Marvel while in business school, because I ended up buying a bunch of Marvel stock. But I was never, Marvel basically went bankrupt in the late 90s and made a lot of bad deals, a lot of bad licensing deals, and we're still seeing the ramifications of those to this day. We're just now seeing a lot of the Marvel characters going back to Marvel where they belong after the Fox acquisition. And yeah, so I was very aware, but there are so many examples of that in history where people would pass on Gone with the Wind because they say, hey, who wants to watch a Civil War movie? Or there's one producer who had the rights to the Harry Potter franchise and basically gave him away for $250,000 to yet another producer who went over to Warner Brothers and made billions and billions of dollars. I mean, yeah, it's a tale as old as time itself, where people fail to see the potential or the value of something when it's staring them square in the face. But to their credit, when they had the option to buy all these Marvel characters, there wasn't a whole lot of examples to show just how valuable Marvel could be. Like Blade, which was a Z-level character, was a hit in the late 90s. X-Men in 2000 was a pretty good success, but not by any stretch of the imagination a runaway success. So I think, to be fair, there wasn't a lot of evidence at that point to suggest that one day the Marvel Cinematic Universe would reinvent the movie business as we know it.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I like you, I've been paying attention to business and to a lesser degree the movie business over the last 20 years, right? And so I remember the head scratching when Thor was coming out. People were like, why on earth would anybody want to watch movies about Thor? Now we have Thor Ragnarok, and the Avengers movies are some of the biggest movies ever made. So now we know the answer. Everybody wants to watch movies about Thor. But I remember some of the skepticism, and so I totally get it.
My business school students that were like in my classmate told me to sell all my Marvel stock in like 07. They're like, man, when they make that Robert Downey Jr. movie, it's going to flop. He's a drug addict. He's a mess. Like short the stock. Don't buy the stock. And I was like, all right, y'all keep talking. And like 2 years later, Disney acquired Marvel. And I was like, he who lasts longest.
And that's a fascinating one. So I had always assumed, thinking about the trajectory of the trajectory of comic book movies, right? You obviously have the Michael Keaton Batman, and then you have the Christopher Nolan Batmans, you have Spider-Man. But for me, I had had the sense, and this book sort of backs me up on this. I had the sense that that Iron Man movie with Robert Downey Jr., that was one of those things where that was like a coin toss. If that movie hadn't gone well, I don't know if the Marvel Cinematic Universe would have taken off as well as it did.
They bet the library on that movie, without a doubt.
And they did, and it was a total hit. And on top of that, they sort of doubled down on the gambling because Robert Downey Jr., up until that point, was cold product. He was like
uninsurable.
Yeah. He was no completion guarantee insurance. You know, the insurance companies that guarantee that these super expensive movies will eventually get made and not everybody's going to completely lose, you know, get defrauded by, some movie-making scam artist, or the movie's going to turn into some, like, Waterworld-level disaster in production. They wouldn't insure this guy because he was going to, you know, he was liable to just overdose on the movie set. And now we all know, actually, he had totally... That was, like, one of my favorite comic book performances of all time. He was so funny in that movie.
Also, when I heard he was being cast, I immediately recognized the potential because every Marvel fan knew that in the 70s and 80s, that Tony Stark, the character, wrestled with alcohol problems. And like one of the most famous story arcs of all time was the Demon in the Bottle series. So for me, it seemed like the perfect casting. I think, oh, of course, you got to have somebody with a history of substance abuse in order to capture Tony Stark's personality. But I think a lot of people... Most of the time, if they're looking at the history of comic book movies, they'll think, oh, like Christopher Reeve as Superman or Michael Keaton as Batman. They have certain archetypes in their mind. It never would occur to them that a superhero could have horrible substance abuse problems. But that's always been part of the secret sauce over at Marvel, is that their characters have flaws. Like Thor, the fact that early in the 60s, he actually was a crippled doctor who had to tap his cane on the ground to turn into Thor. Or Spider-Man, how he had money problems and girl problems and bullies harassing him at school. Marvel's always had these flawed characters with very human problems. But I think most people, prior to the ascent of Marvel, most of what they knew about superheroes came from DC properties, which tend to be more iconic, more mythic, more larger than life. And so it's just a different the two companies have always had very different vibes for their characters.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the, I think Fritz identifies a bunch of different trends, which are why we are seeing, you know, for just the everyday moviegoer, anybody that's just paying attention, for instance, to the commercials of movies that are getting marketed to them, like a common lament will be, oh, why aren't they making like adult movies anymore? Why are there always sequels? Why are there always comic book movies, et cetera? And so one of the things that Fritz identifies is the phenomenon of you will make a ton of money if you make a franchise movie. There are a number of different reasons for that. One of them is people are excited to leave the house and pay extra money if they know it's this big event movie, and people sort of have it ingrained in their brains that Star Wars, Marvel movies, DC movies perhaps, Harry Potter movies. Like, these movies are big event movies, and you have to go see it in a movie theater.
Yeah, it's a big brand, and it's a weird thing where movies have always had branding, whether it's Planet of the Apes or James Bond, but now this idea that movie studios and filmmakers are measured and judged according to how well they serve those brands and sustain them and grow them. And I think that's the big distinction between now and, say, like late 70s, early 80s, where like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg were on the ascent, and guys like Paul Schrader were bemoaning the changes in the business, because obviously from the 70s to the early 80s, Hollywood changed radically, and guys who were writing movies like Taxi Driver or directing movies like American Gigolo suddenly found themselves kind of wondering, like, what? I no longer recognize the industry in which I work, in the town in which I live. But even then, they really, like, those Steven Spielberg movies felt like Steven Spielberg movies, as opposed to, like, Close Encounters of the Third Kind was not a brand. It was a Steven Spielberg event. And now, apart from a few rare exceptions, like with, like, how James Gunn's associated with the Guardians of the Galaxy, you very rarely have brands or franchises that are closely associated with one storyteller. Harry Potter, obviously, would be a major exception. Obviously, J.K. Rowling wrote all the books, and now she writes the screenplays for the Fantastic Beasts movies. But I think for people who want distinctive, original, idiosyncratic, singular voices in their storytelling, I can totally understand why they bemoan some of the changes, because you very rarely get a Christopher Nolan associated with the Batman franchise. I think you get a lot of kind of faceless, kind of anonymous storytelling sometimes. And so I think there are a lot of justifiable frustrations. But when I was a little kid in the 1980s, reading Marvel Comics, reading DC Comics, I dreamed of a day where all these characters that I knew to be cool would be accepted by the world at large, and I could see their potential. So I have a different relationship with the current climate where I do enjoy a lot of them and I do actively seek them out, but I don't want them to be the only option at the theater. Like, if you can't see a movie like American Gigolo in the theater because there's Aquaman and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and nothing else, that's a huge problem. And obviously, a lot of those filmmakers and storytellers are fleeing to TV. But when I see movies like Hereditary and First Reformed and Mandy, like, you know, really original movies coming out, I think a lot of times just older people, they get a little rose-colored glasses about the past, and they're failing to take into account some of the shining examples that film is alive and well. Or like The House That Jack Built. Like, there are some really groundbreaking movies being made. They're just obviously on a much smaller scale than Aquaman.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, going back to – I mean, part of the reason why these movies are such huge hits are because of it isn't just the kids. It's because of people like you and me. I mean – my last comic book that I read during my when I was reading a lot of comic books, I started playing football when I was in high school, so I was reading less comic books at that point. And but I remember, like, my last comic books were, what is it, The Infinity War?
The Jonathan Hickman one?
The series. I actually reread it recently, the one where Thanos gets the entire Infinity Gauntlet.
Well, the original limited series, Infinity Gauntlet, 1-6.
Yes, thank you.
From the early 90s. But yeah, Infinity War, I'm nerding out now, but Infinity War is actually the follow-up limited series.
No. But it was the Infinity Gauntlet. And I remember I even read the prequels, which were when Thanos was going around acquiring all the Infinity Stones.
I mean,
I thought, like, Thanos is my favorite supervillain of all time.
Jim Starlin wrote him really well. Like, in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, Jim Starlin wrote every single Thanos story, and he understood that character better than anybody.
And so when I realized that the Marvel Cinematic Universe, this phase, was moving towards, you know, the thing I left off on, like, this was like manna from heaven. And absolutely, I remember when I was a kid, one of the things I daydreamed about, because I was a massive consumer of books and movies and television, one of the things I dreamed about was, wouldn't it be awesome if there were comic book movies and I could actually see these people? And so, like, yeah, absolutely. I'm one of the people that buys these tickets. Interestingly enough, another major trend that is happening that is, some people say is, or Fritz is arguing is part of the reason why you're seeing the shift at Hollywood and in the Hollywood studios away from the more adult fare and towards the franchise era is streaming. Streaming and peak television taking the place of some of these adult dramas. I remember being a kid.
Yeah, like Sharp Objects on HBO. Like, Sharp Objects had a lot of teeth and was a really dark drama, and I absolutely loved and adored it. But in the late 80s, that would have been a feature film. Like, in the late 80s and early 90s, when movies like Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct could be mainstream successes, it is a little, makes me a little sad when I see that adult sexual thrillers could be mainstream successes 30 years ago, and now, because you can't open them in China, never in a million years would Hollywood even dream of it. Although, I guess you still have movies like 50 Shades of Grey, which obviously make piles of money, but they don't seem to have the edge to them and the darkness to them that some of those sexual thrillers did. So, yeah, it is incredible just how rapidly things have changed and how so many of those adult dramas have fled to the small screen.
But they are, at the same time, a fulfillment of, like, you know, the John Lobinger 12-year-old, like, daydreaming, where I dreamt of a day where I could just turn on my TV and pick whatever TV show and movie I wanted to watch. Now, granted, I didn't realize I was going to have to subscribe to, like, 15 different things in order to do it. But nonetheless, this is still, like, you know, this is still an amazing development for people to be able to just watch whatever they want to watch and not have the dictates of the television network or the movie schedule over at the movie theater.
Oh, yeah. Like, in the 80s, when you would just watch what's on, like, the idea of having choice. Like, you might do a little channel surfing, but I watched so many movies just because it was the least lame option available. And, like, all right, well, I've got to watch something, so let's just watch Baby Geniuses for the 10th time, you know, on HBO.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And that is obviously changing the entire business landscape. You talked about investing, and I think you mentioned that you invested. Did you invest in Netflix as well? I know you invest in Disney.
Yeah, I've still got my Disney stock, because when I bought all my Marvel stock, I converted to Disney stock, and so they basically, like, you got like an even swap plus a little bit of cash on top. My Netflix relationship is more varied because I made a lot of stupid mistakes where I bought Netflix early, wrote it up, and then it had a period of volatility where I wrote it down, I panicked, and I sold it. I bought it again, wrote it down even further, and basically eradicated or erased most of my gains. And then about 6 months ago, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to buy it and keep it. And I'm not going to look at it for, because I don't have the stomach for daily volatility. I tend to buy and hold for a very long time. So I finally just made up my mind, I'm going to buy some Netflix and pretend I don't even have it for 5 years and then just see where it stands. Because if I try to time the market, I tend to lose.
Well, they have had an insane ride. So in my notes, I read The Economist. And by the way, at some point this podcast went from being a movie podcast to I'm talking about an Economist article I read, so that's pretty funny. But I read an article in The Economist which is talking about how Netflix was worth $180 billion. And I just randomly before this episode decided I would check and confirm that that was still the case, and it is not. It is now at $120 billion, so they've lost one-third of their value over the last, like, 6 months. $60 billion is a lot of money.
$60 billion will always be missed.
So, but they're interesting because they haven't made any money, and why that's relevant to everybody is because Netflix is pretty clearly playing to be, like, the next big cable company model. Like, their valuation only makes sense if the people that invest in it think that it's essentially going to be a global cable network and that the platform is going to be so ubiquitous that eventually the streaming wars are going to wind up and it's going to be like, if you want content to make it to people's homes, you have to go to Netflix because that's the thing everybody subscribes to.
Yeah, it's a growth story. I can remember at one point when Netflix had 20 million subscribers and someone was saying, oh, they've reached like a saturation point. It's not going any higher. And I was like, there are a lot more people on this planet than that, so let's see. And I think now they have 130 million paying subscribers, which is definitely something that shouldn't be overlooked, because if you have 130 million people paying you anywhere from like 8 to like 12 bucks a month, that's so much regular revenue with which you can acquire and or develop or produce or distribute new content. And that gives them a huge lead or advantage over a lot of these other platforms that are just trying to get started now and are trying to play catch up. And I think they're going to be one. I don't think it's going to be a winner takes all scenario in the years to come. I think there's room for 4 to 5 major players. Maybe in America they've reached the saturation point. But when I see them making movies like The Night Comes for Us in Indonesia or making TV shows with Indian crews and cast.
Yeah.
They clearly have their eyes set on a much wider global marketplace. And so I think the story of Netflix is only getting started.
Oh, absolutely. So to stick on Netflix for a minute, like they, what is it, 60 million subscribers in the U.S. and 137 million worldwide. And they are making shows that are like hits in Germany and hits in Brazil. They have
Was one of the coolest shows of last year, and it was, I think, a Swiss writer with a German director. It's a husband-wife team where they do everything together, and they write and direct every episode together. But it was one of the coolest shows of 2017 by far.
Absolutely. And so one of the advantages, so they've got that advantage in that they are like getting pretty good at being able to cross borders with their content. They have the advantage of they are making more content than anybody else. $13 billion. I mean, I think it's like they put out 700 original shows they did 82 feature-length films when Warner Brothers, the next biggest studio, did 23 in the same time period. I mean, they are just putting out so much content. Saturday Night Live, did you see the Saturday Night Live joke that they had about Netflix?
I did not.
Oh, it's hilarious because they said essentially Netflix is reaching the singularity, that when they have so many TV shows and movies that by the time you scroll to the end of any of the programs you're looking at, there'll be new programs. And so you can never actually see everything that Netflix has made.
Oh, mathematically it's impossible, but that's a beautiful thing. It's a buffet and you get to pick and choose, but while they make a lot of forgettable just content that would just disappear into obscurity, They're also doing things like The Irishman with Martin Scorsese. So I don't understand why people are fighting Netflix or resisting Netflix, because I feel like they're at least putting their money where their mouth is and trying to do some great work. Or I see them making Westerns with the Coen brothers, making documentaries with Errol Morris. I think a lot of people look down on Netflix when they should not, because they've been the friend to and the investor in a lot of great filmmakers.
Oh, no question, no question. I have positive feelings about Netflix. I think actually most of my positive feelings are I'm turned on, my business sense is turned on by like all the stuff that I read about them and some of their strategy. One of the other things they do is, yeah, they put out a lot of stuff, but they have so much data about what people are into, and they've been working, you know, a lot of people are getting into Moneyball for movies over the last like 5 years, but Netflix has been at the forefront of trying to calculate exactly who wants to see what, how much time they're willing to spend watching it, and then also things as like specific as what if we show you a trailer, what are the things in the trailer that will turn you on to actually get you to want to watch that TV show. So the trailer that you see on Netflix might be totally different than the trailer that, say, like, you know, the girl I've started dating, or like some 16-year-old boy in Mexico. Like, we all are going to see different trailers based off of our taste preferences that they've calculated. It's both a little bit creepy, but it's also a little bit awesome.
Yeah, I guess the fact that we're being targeted so specifically is a little creepy and intrusive. However, they do a really good job of it. Whether you're on YouTube or Netflix, whatever the case may be, I'd say 9 out of 10 of the suggestions they make are at least vaguely appealing or kind of good. So I, once again, it's just one of those things where you can choose. Like, all this information they have on us, we're voluntarily putting it on the internet. So if you don't want people targeting you according to specific tastes and interests, then just stay off the internet and you're safe.
Whereas you and I are totally the opposite.
Yeah.
Camp.
Go for a run, take a nap. Like, you know, they can't get you.
Whereas you and I are the opposite. We are putting so much information about ourselves out there between Twitter and Facebook, and you've got your
Absolutely.
YouTube channel. And oh yeah, no, I'm easy to sell stuff to.
We live in fascinating times. What's that old like Chinese like curse and or blessing? May you live in interesting times. I think we live in very interesting times. And it's funny how my interest in film criticism is seriously on the decline, but my interest in film information is on the rise. And when I come across books like The Big Picture, it really feeds the beast and adds a lot of gasoline to the fire. Also, for people who are curious about Ben Fritz, the way I discovered the book was through a podcast that he recorded with Brett Easton Ellis. Brett Easton Ellis' podcast is unfortunately behind a paywall for Patreon subscribers, but I think it's the best film podcast out there, because every episode opens with a rant about movies, followed by an interview with a writer or a director, whatever the case might be. And in this particular episode, he probably did the best rant about Hereditary that'll ever be recorded by a human being. It's what drove me to see it. And then he has this interview with Ben Fritz where they're talking about Hereditary and First Reformed. They're talking about the book. They're talking about changes in the industry. But it was an absolutely extraordinary, riveting interview. It gets my absolute highest possible recommendation, but I've become a Wall Street Journal subscriber again just so I can read Ben Fritz's articles over there on that particular website. But it seems like he hasn't been that active lately, so something tells me he's probably working on an update to this book, because so much has changed since the book came out just in the last year that it needs an update. I mean, the Sony story continues to evolve. The fact that they basically, with Spider-Man 3 and Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2, kind of ran the franchise into the ground. Granted, the movies were still making money, but it was a situation of diminishing returns, which basically gave an opportunity for Kevin Feige to swoop into the rescue with Spider-Man Civil War and things like that, and kind of resurrect people's interest in the character. But this past fall, a movie that I despise was one of the world's biggest successes of this year, which was Venom.
Yes.
And obviously that is an Amy Pascal-produced movie.
Yes.
But now with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, a movie I loved, it's interesting seeing how quickly the story of Sony has evolved since the publication of this particular book.
Oh yeah, and there's been so much evolution, because while Disney is, and we really need to talk about Venom, because this brings together a bunch of different trends and a bunch of changes and updates since the book. But the other thing is, Disney's fortunes have changed a little bit. I mean, they're still crushing it at the box office, and they're still the number one most profitable blockbuster cultivator, movie maker, all of that good stuff. But they've put the Star Wars spin-offs, they've sort of put them in development hell and stalled the release of them.
Tapped the brakes.
Because Solo was a bit of a debacle. I mean, Solo made a lot of money. I don't know if it was profitable. I think it may have lost money.
It was not. It's the first Star Wars movie to lose money.
And so now it's interesting because why is that? I mean, a big part of it is there was so much negative buzz coming out before it about first they got rid of the co-directors. And you were talking about the trend away from
Phil auteurism. Lord and Chris Miller, who are also producers and writers on Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which is just delightful. I was thinking, man, I wonder how Solo would have turned out if they had not been fired.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and the core fan base, even though they're probably going to go to Solo movies no matter what, they definitely are like disproportionately influential on the sort of buzz that movies have. And a big part of the marketing push towards these movies is everybody's going to go see Rogue One, for instance. And so you go and you see Rogue One, and whether you like it or not, you go home and your kids buy the toys. But if the buzz is, oh my gosh, who is this Ehrenreich guy? Why is he getting acting lessons? Why are they firing the co-directors? Then even though the people that are really paying attention to that stuff, they may still go see the movie. One, they might not go see it two or three times like they would otherwise. Two, they're sort of signaling to everybody else, you don't need to go to this, you can just stay home. This is going to be an epic mess. And so now Disney's fortunes have changed a little bit. But yeah, absolutely. What's interesting?
Yeah, the Disney four-legged stool is like live action remakes of animation classics, Disney animation, Star Wars, and Marvel. But if one of those legs to that stool goes away or is diminished, that definitely changes their model. And so I think they recognize that a course correction is necessary, because it's one thing if you want to target specific members of the population or political spectrum with your movies, but if you want to have everybody come, choosing sides is not necessarily the best thing to do. And one of the things that blew my mind about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is that it's one of those movies that takes everything that people love about Spider-Man from the early 60s to today and then builds upon it. It doesn't try to wipe the slate clean or tell you that you're toxic because you like Spider-Man in the early 60s. It says, if you've ever loved Spider-Man ever, this is the movie for you. And not only that, we're going to give you a bunch of new stuff and a bunch of new characters you might not be familiar with. And it really blew my mind just how different it was strategically compared to a movie like Last Jedi, where they basically said, we're going to make fun of the past and make room for the new in service of Rian Johnson's vision. And if you like the way Star Wars used to be, well, you can go fuck yourself. You're toxic. That's fine as long as you want to lower your expectations in terms of box office, or if you're happy with selling fewer toys. But look at Star Trek Discovery. If you want to sell toys and you want to sell ears and you want to sell all the merch and you want people to go to the conventions, you better make sure every single Star Trek fan that's ever lived wants to watch Star Trek Discovery. And it's really interesting seeing how who does that well, like Avengers Infinity War, obviously grossed over $2 billion. Every Marvel fan of every age, shape, or size across the planet is going to see Infinity War. And that's one thing that fascinates me. Like, how do you nurture a fan base across several decades and keep different generations, different demographics, and different political persuasions all happy at the same time? It's incredibly challenging to do.
Oh, absolutely. And Disney is willing to put the brakes on stuff. I mean, that's part of their recipe for success, why they make 30% profits just on the films alone. Forget the fact that they also can make direct profits off of toys and merchandise, although I think Marvel still gets a cut of all that. But they also make a ton of money off of – they have amusement rides that people are going to travel across the country, travel across the world to go pay and ride on. And they're being promoted, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean. And all of that good stuff. So they're profitable on so many different levels. And so they're willing to take the time and really make sure that the recipe is 100% correct on these films, and that's what we're seeing right now.
Well, they make fewer movies now. Like Bob Iger's whole attitude and his whole sea change in the 2000s was, let's make fewer movies and make more of the movies that work and fewer of the movies that are a risk, which is why you no longer see them doing like Jerry Bruckheimer action movies like they did in the early 2000s, where really it's all global marketplace movies that the entire family can go to. If it won't play in China,
yes,
then they're not going to make it.
So Venom is a fascinating way to wrap up a lot of these threads, right? Because First of all, so Amy Pascal, for anybody that wasn't paying attention during the Sony hack, Amy Pascal lost her job. Now, ostensibly, like, it could be because of the fact that Sony wasn't exactly crushing it for a while, and there were changes going on in the environment, like, that we've discussed, and perhaps she wasn't responding quickly enough. But I think a lot of people also think that due to some of the controversy from some of the emails around the Sony hack, she wasn't necessarily able to do her job as well. However, like, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, because she then became the producer of both, like, Steven Spielberg art house award winner films like The Post, and she also did Spider-Man Homecoming. Interesting thing about Spider-Man Homecoming is Spider-Man had been outside the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but this amazing deal happened where they brought Spider-Man back into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, even though Sony got to keep all the money. And even though Amy Pascal threw a fucking sandwich at Kevin Feige, which is one of my favorite visuals in the book.
Well, it's one of the things where I think a lot of times people outside of comics don't understand how important the internal logic of these shared universes might be. And from Amy Pascal's perspective, she's probably thinking, who cares if Spider-Man's inside the cinematic universe or not? Spider-Man is Spider-Man. But for comic book fans, it'd be like somebody doing a spinoff of, like, Hercules that's detached from the rest of Greek mythology. It's like, no, right. Hercules is part of Greek mythology. He's part of that tapestry. He needs to be part of that story. Or somebody tried to do a spinoff of Hermione, which had nothing to do with the rest of the Harry Potter universe.
There was no Hogwarts. It was just Hermione.
Yeah, exactly. Spider-Man belongs with the Marvel Cinematic Universe because he's part of the fabric of that entire world. He was the poster child of Marvel for so many generations. But for her to have to admit that she had kind of struck a reef and that she needed the help creatively to kind of resurrect people's interest in Spider-Man, but it worked. Obviously, Homecoming was the creative was handled by Marvel, the financing and distribution handled by Sony, so it was a win-win for everybody involved. And now, obviously, Spider-Man appeared in Infinity War. He got Far From Home coming. Spider-Man's now a viable character again. And Sony's basically doing these in association with Marvel movies where they right. use the logo, but they're basically making villain movies and secondary character movies in and around the Spider-Man character. And I was really just – I was bruised by Venom because it felt like a movie from 2003, like the Tim Story Fantastic Four movies or like the Daredevil back then with Ben Affleck. Like it really felt like – they'd gone back in time 15 years and failed to recognize that comic book movies have gotten better and improved. But what do I know? If they listened to me, maybe the movie wouldn't have made $800 million. But man, I hated that flick.
Yeah, so she then goes on to do what I think is Sony's biggest hit of this year, which is Venom, which make, like you said, like $800 million. But it made a ton of money in China. They actually aligned, I think, I don't know if it was production or distribution, but they had Tencent Productions, which is a Chinese company. They were a part of it, and a huge Chinese release.
Yeah, I think it broke a bunch of records, and the Chinese marketplace just keeps growing by leaps and bounds. I mean, that's one thing the book captures really well is how few theaters there were prior to Avatar, but then that the 3D experience drove the construction of quite literally thousands of new theaters. And it's interesting, it's seeing Chinese investment coming in, like Paramount, I think at this point, is 49% owned by Chinese money. And just the idea that Chinese censorship or Chinese, I guess, cultural values have an impact on what we see. Because obviously China's a different culture, they have quite a different government. And it's interesting how we have creative handcuffs on a lot of our big movies. Like the Star Wars movies can't open in China because they have the Force. And that's a huge impact on them because you can't have weird religions or faiths in your movies and open in China just due to their censorship rules, which is one of the reasons why Ghostbusters, the remake, wasn't able to open over there. And this is a new thing where Hollywood is tapping the brakes creatively in order to offer concessions to a completely different marketplace. And I think that story, I think we're only at the beginning of that relationship where we have almost like Hollywood and China have like a symbiotic relationship with each other where the money's flowing both ways and the talent's flowing both ways. And it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves. But I have a feeling people who are frustrated with the current landscape, they're going to only become more frustrated because I have a feeling that relationship's only going to intensify in the years to come.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Legendary is now owned by Wanda Corporation. And so when you see a movie like Pacific Rim Uprising and you're like, why the fuck is this movie in existence? And you're like, oh, that's why. That's why. This is a kaiju movie that is also like a big hit in China.
And same with Warcraft. Warcraft was a huge flop in America, but it was a massive success over in China. So, and I used to play a ton of World of Warcraft, so I enjoyed it to a degree. But it is interesting seeing how movies can really get a second life over there.
Yeah. So, and we've also talked about, like you say, there are certainly signals that if you have any complaints about the current state of affairs at your local multiplex, you may have reasons to complain going forward. But there are also lots of reasons to be excited as well. And you talk about A24. You talk about the investments that Netflix. I mean, and obviously Amazon has gone above and beyond in terms of investing in all sorts of weird movies. Suspiria this year. Like, that is a, whether you love it or hate it, I tend to be more on the love it side. Like, that is a bizarre movie. And
it's wildly ambitious.
Yeah.
And it shows us things that we've never seen before in horror movies. The stuff that worked, like the hour and a half that worked, was some of the coolest stuff I've seen all year. And then it's got an hour that probably belonged in a separate movie entirely. But it's incredible just how, I like seeing filmmakers reach for the stars, even if they don't quite make it.
Me too. There are a bunch of different pockets and people that are investing and still see a lot of value in continuing to meet these needs of more adult, more sophisticated, more ambitious filmmaking. It just might not be coming from Sony or Disney anymore. And, it's like, are you okay with that? I mean, I think for most of us, as long as we can get our grubby little hands on it one way or the other, whether it's through streaming, whether it's at the movie theater, whether it's, I mean, whatever, we just... if we can continue to get sophisticated, interesting stuff, you know, because if you've been consuming the same media drugs over the years, like, you still need something new. You need something to up the ante. And for me, like, movies like Suspiria, that's the stuff for me. Like, that's what pushes the limits of the things I've already seen. I'm glad that people are continuing to invest in it, and hopefully places like Annapurna and A24 and Amazon Studios will continue to do so.
Well, Annapurna obviously is a huge part of the book as well, because when Amy Pascal was trying to get Steve Jobs up and running, she kept hoping that Annapurna would swoop into the rescue and give her some of the additional financing that she required. But Annapurna, their fortunes have changed as well. I mean, only recently you saw Megan Ellison's father basically saying, "Look, y'all are hemorrhaging cash. You make a lot of great movies, but you just spent $60 million on Vice. Maybe it's time for y'all to think about running Annapurna Pictures like a business, as opposed to your personal, extremely expensive vanity project." So there's some fundamental kind of like firings and rehirings and just personnel changes taking place over at Annapurna. But it'll be interesting to see how that evolves, because when she first arrived on the scene and was giving a green light to Paul Thomas Anderson movies and giving a green light to Catherine Bigelow movies, she really seemed like she was going to be the best cool new producer in the business. But not all those movies have seen like the dice come up seven. Like, I know Catherine Bigelow's most recent one,
Detroit,
underperformed.
Yeah,
yeah. But I've seen Vice. I can't talk about it till tomorrow. That's when the embargo ends. But that's a $60 million movie, which may or may not make its money back. So it's gonna. Once again, the story is always evolving and changing. And I think what the future holds for Megan Ellison is definitely well worth watching or paying attention to.
Absolutely. James, so is there anything else that we have? By the way, I should just stop, because I think it is a hilarious mental visual to have Megan Ellison, who is this extremely powerful Hollywood mogul, to have her dad come in and say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! Like, what are you doing? We're gonna cut off some of the money if you don't get this together."
Well, the money comes from someplace, and it doesn't come initially from her. I mean, the fact that her father founded Oracle has a Larry Ellison that has a huge impact on just how much the money might flow on some of their future projects. So, but she has managed to accumulate a pretty interesting body of work in a very short period of time. I think she's only like 32, 33 years old, so she's still a very young producer, and she obviously has superb taste in movies, loves like John Cassavetes and Robert Altman and those kind of figures. So I think she's one of those people that will continue to fight for people who want to see more movies by idiosyncratic, dangerous, off the beaten track, distinctive original voices. She's one of those producers that will make those movies happen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, has a single Paul Thomas Anderson movie, maybe Boogie Nights might have made money, but has a single one since then made money? Not a chance. And so it's awesome.
Yeah, I would need to check the box office of There Will Be Blood, but I'm assuming it wasn't doing Venom numbers.
not a huge appetite in China for There Will Be Blood.
Exactly.
So, James, thank you so much for coming on. As I've said, you're sort of like the granddaddy of this podcast, of Film Baby Film, because my first podcast I ever went on was Criterion Now. And the guy who created Criterion Now, his first podcast he ever went on was yours. And I'm
we were talking Samuel Fuller. We met at the Film Forum in New York, and we saw Pick Up on South Street. And I remember Mikhail and I invited Aaron, and we said, hey, you want to come over to my place? We're about to record a podcast. So he came over. He hiked up to my fourth-story walk-up, and we recorded an episode. And 2 months later, he had his own podcast. But we'll need to do some spitballing about a topic to lure you over to Wrong Reel for an episode.
Absolutely. So I guess let's do the outro. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you? I mean, obviously, you have a much bigger audience than I do, so they probably know where to find you, but, you know, let's just do the formality.
You can find Wrong Reel on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play Music, all those usual platforms. You can find my YouTube channel, Geeking with James Hancock, on YouTube. Just Google my name, James Hancock, and you'll see my big, shiny, bald head, and slowly but surely, the channel's growing. I'm knocking at the door at 10,000 subscribers, so I'm really hoping to cross that threshold. It'll be the perfect Christmas present for me. My Twitter profile is @Colbrax, and you can find Wrong Reel, Facebook, Twitter, all the usual places.
I saw you got 32,000 hits on the Sharp Objects finale episode review.
I think it's up to 37 now. So yeah, I'm very proud of that video. So,
I mean,
yeah,
I literally saw that. I looked at that like a few days ago. So good for you. You're picking up the views quickly. Is that your most successful YouTube clip yet?
My biggest video was actually my season one review of Dark, that German show I mentioned on Netflix, a show that never in a million. I actually posted the review late, and I was thinking, oh, maybe a couple hundred people will watch this. I have plenty of videos that go totally ignored, and every once in a while, just due to just the machinery of the internet, the stars are aligned, and I'm getting some traffic. So Dark's my number one video, which is totally strange and perplexing to me, but slowly but surely, I'm starting to get some traffic on, like, my House That Jack Built video is getting some traffic, and the Ballad of Buster Scruggs is getting some traffic. So for a while, it was just TV that was doing well on my channel, but now some of my film reviews are starting to do well, like my The Night Comes for Us, that Indonesian action movie, that got some decent traffic. So I'm very excited about the YouTube channel, and Wrong Reel, my YouTube channel, will probably start to merge and overlap a little bit more in 2019, because I want to start doing live streams and interviews on the channel and that sort of thing. So in an ever-changing landscape, I think we need to be ever-changing and adapting ourselves.
Absolutely. So everybody, if you're not already involved in the Wrong Reel cinematic universe, you're definitely going to want to get in on it now. James, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for the invite.